Hi, this is the On the Keys podcast, and I'm your host, David Kaiser. Thanks for tuning in. On this show, the inner workings of music, and the latest and greatest for the piano, also stories, lore, and an altogether relaxing and educational good time, where history is important, but new composers given their due. It's the On the Keys podcast, a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Please subscribe wherever you can find podcasts, and tell your friends. I promise they'll enjoy it. It's educational. From South Carolina Public Radio, this is On the Keys, an hour of piano music played by virtuoso pianists. On this two-part series, an in-depth exploration of sonata form. Douglas Weeks, professor of piano at Converse College, in this hour will lead us through some essential basics of harmony, using words like tonic and dominant, and then highlight how Mozart uses a seemingly simple form to make his work sound charming, beautiful, dramatic, and yes, magical. Sonata form is not merely an archaic formality, but in Douglas Weeks' words, an internal struggle for dominance. And when we get to Beethoven next week, the struggle takes on Shakespearean portions of drama. Both shows will be available to listen to on demand at our website, scpublicradio.org. Also online will be a fact sheet with terms and concepts and where those terms are talked about during the program, with exact timestamps, allowing you to follow along at your own pace, facilitating the use of the pause and rewind button that we don't have at our disposal on the radio. Are you ready? Lights up, action.
Sonata form, or sonata allegro form as it is sometimes called, developed gradually in the mid-18th century, primarily in Germany and Austria, and mostly through the efforts of Haydn, Mozart, and J.C. Bach. It was a complex evolution involving myriad experiments with changes to existing forms, and it reached maturity in the sonatas of Beethoven, whose works defined the classical norm as we think of it today. Its durability is such that it was used in its basic outline by composers throughout the 19th and 20th centuries in solo sonatas, chamber works for multiple instruments, and, of course, symphonies. And the basic outline, while preserving essentials, provides so many possibilities for alteration and elaboration that sonata form movements can substantially differ one from another. It was sonata form that broke from Baroque forms in two profoundly significant ways. It made possible the creation of two or more contrasting moods, emotions, etc., within a single movement, as opposed to just one character or emotion. And perhaps even more importantly, it allowed the establishment of two different home keys within a movement, resulting in a kind of polarization of the two, something that did not exist in traditional forms of the Baroque and earlier eras. I'll explain this in more detail down the road. A sonata form movement has three large sections: the exposition, the development, and the recapitulation, that are usually quite distinct and made so by keys, themes, textures, rhythm, and cadences. Above all, sonata form is about tonal structure. And to hear and understand the tonal design of sonata form, meaning hearing keys and hearing key relationships, it is vitally important to hear when we are in a key, when we are leaving a key and moving towards a new key, and when we have arrived and established a new key. And so for those music lovers listening who have never played an instrument nor have ever taken a music theory course, here is a primer of Western tonality starting essentially from square one. Our music is based on 12 distinct pitches: A, B flat, B, C, etc., that are repeated in different registers or octaves. On the modern piano, for example, this chromatic scale of 12 pitches covers seven octaves: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that with a few additional pitches, total 88. Here, just for fun, are all 88 pitches played almost at the same time. Debussy would surely approve. For many centuries, Western music was based on 8 church modes, meaning 8 different scales. But over time, this evolved to a system based on only 2 principal scales, the major scale and the minor scale, with each scale structure determined by the intervallic distance between the 7 pitches. Actually, there are variants of the minor scale, but let's not go there. Distance between pitches is measured by what are called steps. On the piano, adjoining keys are half steps. That's a half step, that's a half step, and 2 half steps make a whole step. That's a whole step, that's a whole step. The intervallic structure of a major scale is whole step, whole step, half step, whole step, whole step, whole step, half step. A major scale beginning on any pitch can be constructed using this formula. David, name a key.
Let's say B major.
B major. Whole step, whole step, half step, whole step, whole step, whole step, half step. And now to the crux. Over the centuries, Western music evolved into a complex harmonic system of tonality where music is in a key. And everything heard relates to a central key. Chords are formed from scales. And all chords arising from a scale relate to that scale key in varying degrees of strength. Thus, we can think of a home key as a star, the cosmic kind, and the chords within that scale as orbiting planets with varying degrees of gravitational pull. We create chords within a key by building 3-note triads based on the notes of the scale and built on the interval of the third. So the chord built on the first note of a C major scale is C, E, G. The chord built on the second scale degree of C major is D, F, A, which is a D minor chord. The chord built on the third scale degree, C, D, E, is E, G, B, which is an E minor chord, etc. Now, a C major chord is a C major chord is a C major chord, and that is immutable. It does not change. But once I name a key, every chord gains functionality, meaning that in the key of C, the C major chord is home base. It is called the tonic chord, and its symbol is a Roman numeral, uppercase 1. The chord built on the second scale degree in the key of C is called the supertonic. It has the Roman numeral 2. The chord built on the third scale degree in the key of C is called the mediant and has the Roman numeral 3. And here are all the chords built on the 7 degrees of a C major scale. The 1 chord, the 2 chord, the 3 chord, the 4 chord, the 5 chord, the 6 chord, and the 7 chord. All these have Roman numerals. The names of the chords are tonic, supertonic, mediant, subdominant, dominant, submediant, and leading tone. In any given major key, the 1, 4, and 5 chords are major, and the 2, 3, and 6 chords are minor, the difference being whether the lower interval in the chord is a major or a minor third. If you grew up in the 60s, how many times did you hear a song that went something like this? That's because the 4 and 5 chords have the strongest gravitational pull to the one chord, the tonic. It is very simply the simplest chord progression that we have. Now, this is very important to understand. The chord functions in its relation to the home key. Thus, as I said before, a C major chord is a C major chord is a C major chord until I name a key whereupon that C major chord gains function. So the C major chord in the key of C is the one chord, but the same C major chord in the key of G is the four chord because now it is built on the fourth scale degree of the G major scale. In the key of A minor, it becomes the three chord. A, B, C, third scale degree, C major chord, three chord in A minor. So if I play a C major chord for a student and ask how the chord functions, the student would be correct to reply, I don't have enough information. What key are we in? If I then told the student that we were in the key of F, the correct answer would be that C is the five chord because it's built on the fifth scale degree in the key of F. And this is the basis, the very bare bones basis of what is called functional harmony or functional tonality. And now we're getting to the crux of the crux. All of these chords are called diatonic chords because none of them have any notes other than those contained in the scale. Nothing strayed, nothing went out of orbit. But once I introduce a note other than these, I have gone out of that scale and hence out of the key. These non-scale pitches are called chromatic notes or chromatic tones. For example, if I'm in the key of C, which has all white keys, but I played a D major chord with an F sharp instead of a D minor chord with an F natural, that D major chord is going out of the orbit of C major because F sharp is not a note in the C major scale. The D major chord is beginning to break away from the gravitational pull of the key of C major, and it might very well be heading towards the gravitational pull of another key. One of the main differences between Western popular music and Western art music is that the large majority of popular songs or instrumental pieces stay in a key or stray relatively little from that key. Here's a patriotic anthem that everyone knows. I'll play it in the key of F. We began and ended in the key of F, and all the chords we heard in this song were built on notes of the F major scale except for one. The chord on the syllable bur in liberty. Bur. It has a C sharp in it, a pitch which is not one of the seven pitches in the F major scale. This C sharp makes an A major chord rather than an A minor chord, and it creates a temporary 5-1 dominant tonic resolution with the next chord, D minor. It is the briefest anointing of D minor as a new home key, a new tonic, but no sooner do we hear it than the progression continues right back to the home key of F. Of thee I sing. This last 5-1 resolution reaffirms that F is indeed our home key and that we haven't really gone anywhere. The rest of the verse doesn't stray at all and consists, in fact, of only 1, 4, and 5 chords in the key of F. We did indeed leave home base, but we strayed so briefly that the ear did not sense that we were leaving behind our home key of F major. And this raises an extremely important aspect of discerning tonal structure, being able to hear when a modulation actually establishes a new key, as opposed to a briefer and more transient departure that does not. One can think of it as a commitment rather than a flirtation. Now, please indulge me in a rather silly analogy, but I like it nonetheless. I think of being in a key as being in a room. My country, 'tis of thee, stays in one room and doesn't stray. However, if we want to go to another room and make that our new home, then we must walk down a hall of some length where the original key signature breaks down. And this breakdown begins a gravitational shift towards a new key and new key signature. Back to my country, 'tis of thee. I'm going to change keys right after the word liberty and move from the key of F major to the key of D minor. Here goes. Your ear perceived this shift of key because the chord progression at the end ended with an A major chord resolving to a D minor chord. An A major chord does not belong to the key of F major, but it sure does belong to the key of D minor. In fact, it creates a very strong 5-1 dominant tonic cadence. And let me interject here that when a dominant tonic cadence is heard in a key other than home key, that dominant is called a secondary dominant. Now I'm going to hammer it home. I'm sorry, but I just couldn't end it in minor. Your ear at some point began to accept the new key of D minor because I kept reinforcing it through both the repetition of strong A major to D minor dominant tonic resolutions and through the sheer length of the D minor section, which was nearly twice as long as the one in F major. Your ear tonicized D minor and made it the new home key. We not only clearly entered a new room, but with the final cadence, we slammed the door shut on the old key. In other words, the old 5 is the new 1. The old dominant is the new tonic. Here is my country, 'tis of thee, once more, played from the very beginning with the key change from F major to D minor. So, a secondary dominant is a very common way to establish a new key if the 5-1 secondary dominant resolutions are repeated many times. This, my country, 'tis of the example of a modulation resulting in the establishment of a new key is a naive yet fairly accurate representation of the first large section of classical sonata form, the exposition. The home key tonic is firmly established at the beginning of the movement. The key signature breaks down at some point and we modulate away from tonic, gravitating towards and eventually arriving in a new key. Unlike Baroque forms, the new key must be firmly planted in such a way so as to gain an importance equal to that of the original key. Achievement achieved through both its length and through a series of strong cadences, the new key becomes so firmly established that it gains polarity with the old key, vying for dominance, pun intended, of the movement. They become two different key areas of equal importance. If the movement begins in a major key, the new key area is usually in the dominant. If the movement begins in a minor key, the new key area is usually in the relative major key, the key built on the third scale degree of the home scale. And I say usually because composers sometimes have tricks up their sleeves and don't arrive where expected, Beethoven and Schubert being prime suspects in the classical era. And this is one of the essential differences between Baroque forms and classical sonata form: the firm establishment of an exploration of a new key area and the polarization of the old and new keys, so much so that they are equally weighted. Consequently, sonata form achieves a kind of tension unrealized in the Baroque period, and the release of that tension through the reestablishment of the home key, especially in the hands of someone like Beethoven, is immensely powerful and gratifying. Before we explore a movement of a Mozart sonata, excuse me, to illustrate how this works in real life, I'd like to talk a bit about cadences, which is essentially another term for resolutions. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines a cadence as, quote, a musical chord sequence moving to a harmonic close or point of rest and giving the sense of harmonic completion, end of quote. It is the cadence that more than anything else delineates the important structural divisions of a sonata form movement. And detecting cadences, both strong and weak, can help the ear to hear these structural divisions. The chord that possesses the strongest gravitational pull to tonic is the 5 chord, the dominant. And when a 5 chord resolves to 1, it is called an authentic cadence. It is also the most common cadence. The chord that has the second strongest gravitational pull to tonic is the 4 chord, the subdominant. Called a plagal cadence, its gravitational pull is still strong, but not as strong as the authentic cadence. A 4-1 cadence sounds like this. Here again is a 5-1 cadence and a 4-1 cadence. The 4-1 cadence is gentler than the 5-1 and sounds less, well, dominant. Amens are frequently 4-1 cadences. Part of this gentler feeling is due to what is called voice leading, but we won't get into that. A given cadence's strength is measured by which pitches are the highest and lowest in the final tonic chord. If, in a 5-1 authentic cadence, both the highest and lowest pitches of the final 1 chord are themselves the tonic pitches, the cadence is called a perfect authentic cadence. Here is the C chord with the highest and lowest pitches being C. And here is a perfect authentic cadence. This perfect authentic cadence is the very strongest of all cadences, providing complete harmonic and melodic closure. In the classical era, sections, movements, and entire pieces will end this way again and again. In fact, of Mozart's 18 or 19 piano sonatas, depending on how you count K533B, the perfect authentic cadence closes every first movement and every last movement every single time. When the highest and or lowest pitches in the final chord are pitches other than the tonic pitches, it is then called an imperfect authentic cadence. Here is a C chord, with the highest pitch being an E. The third scale degree in C, not the first. Here is how an imperfect authentic cadence sounds with an E at the top. Or, here is a C chord with the highest pitch being G, which is the fifth scale degree. And here is how an imperfect authentic cadence sounds with G at the top. All three of these are strong cadences, but the perfect authentic is the strongest. And I say that emphatically. I was listening recently to Billy Joel's beautiful song, And So It Goes. Here is the beginning in the key of C. Down the road is the phrase, so you can make decisions too, and you can have this heart to break. It sounds like this. The cadence at the end on to break is an imperfect authentic cadence because the top pitch of the last C major chord is G, the fifth scale degree. But the song ends, and so it goes, and so it goes, and you're the only one who knows, and it sounds like this. The cadence on the last two words, who knows, is a perfect authentic cadence. The root pitch C is both the highest and lowest note in the final chord. And we feel, without a doubt, that we've come to the end. Half cadences are something else entirely. All the cadences I've been playing resolve to the tonic chord. But a half cadence reverses the process and resolves from tonic to dominant. It creates a huge question mark regarding which tonal direction the music should go in the next part. We'll talk about this again a bit later.
You're listening to On the Keys. On this show, Douglas Weeks shows us the inner workings of sonata form. Sonata form, the drama within.
And now it's time for an actual example of sonata form in action. I'm going to play the first large section, the exposition, of the first movement of Mozart's piano sonata in C major, K309. The letter K stands, by the way, for Kerschel, the name of the person who cataloged Mozart's works. Mozart was only 21 when he composed this sonata. Quite a bit is going on in this exposition. But what I want you to primarily listen for is when we begin to move out of the key of C and when we have arrived in a new key.
Thank you.
Okay, so what did we hear? A two-measure call to attention opens the movement in C. The next phrase continues in C, but the next chord after this is not in the key of C. It's an A major chord with C sharp. That does not belong in C major. So we appear to be going out of orbit right off the bat. But it is extremely short-lived because Mozart immediately resolves back to C through a G-C cadence. And then completes the opening phrase with a formulaic chord progression that ends with a perfect authentic cadence in C. Mozart appeared to be changing keys right off the bat, but it was only a brief flirtation, a tiny red herring, if you will, and it was so brief, lasting in the neighborhood of 1 second, that we didn't really pay any attention to it. Did we go out of key? Yes, but only for a second, literally. Did we establish a new key? No, not even close. Here is a reduction of the opening chord progression. Mozart now repeats the opening five measures. And in the sixth measure, he veers off again, this time to F major, with a secondary dominant that somewhat strengthens the move. However, this is again only a tease, because after beginning the next phrase on F, Mozart immediately resolves back to C, and after the same short formulaic chord progression, appears to be ready to close this opening section, probably like this. But Mozart makes it more interesting because instead of writing a 5-1 authentic cadence like the one I just played, he gives us a deceptive cadence from A minor, from G major to A minor. This A minor chord begins a repetition of the previous four measures. And this opening section ends not only with a strong, perfect, authentic cadence, but also with a trill. We began the sonata's opening section in the key of C, and we ended in the key of C. We flirted with a new key, but so briefly that it didn't amount to anything. As a result of Mozart's phrase structure and the strong, perfect, authentic cadence at the end, we experienced a satisfying closure and hopefully sensed that we had arrived at an important structural division in the movement. And indeed we had, because with this strong cadence, we have arrived at the end of the first key area. And now we're going to make a label change. Different schools have different names for this first key area, but at Florida State, where I did graduate work, I was taught to call it the first subject area. So from now on, subject will mean key. Now I'm going to play this entire first subject area again. It is 30 measures long. Brief straying, right back. Repeat. Brief straying, right back. Heading towards F, but comes right back to C. Deceptive cadence. Okay, so what happens now? The next two measures that we hear are apparently still in C major. We hear repeated two note C major chords. And simultaneously, we hear a rising six-note scale that sounds like C, but that contains two pitches that are not in a C major scale, a D sharp and an F sharp. The presence of these pitches destabilizes our home key. Here's how a C major scale sounds. Here's Mozart's six-note scale. Here's Mozart's scale with the accompaniment. In the next two measures, Mozart repeats what he has just done, but with a G major scale. Again, there are two notes which don't belong. Here's a G major scale. Here is Mozart's scale. Next, we hear a D major scale, but it is different from the previous two because it has C naturals instead of C sharps. Here is a D major scale. Here is Mozart's scale. This is a much more powerful move away from our home key than anything we have heard before, because the C naturals in the scale combine with the D major chord in the bass to create a major minor seventh chord that is begging to resolve to G, creating a strong secondary dominant resolution. Again, Mozart is going out of orbit, but more powerfully and more convincingly than before, largely because we hear this dominant seventh chord for two whole measures instead of for just the half measure that we heard earlier. Here is the entire passage beginning with the C major scale. We seem to have rather effectively moved from the key of C major to the key of G major. The question is, will Mozart quickly turn around and come back, as he's done now twice before, perhaps something like this? Or will he use the secondary dominant to establish a new key? If you said establish a new key, you were right on the money, and here is how he does it. After the D major scale resolves to G, he goes right back again to the D7 chord, and after resolving to G, he immediately goes back again to the D chord, creating a succession of 3-5-1 dominant tonic resolutions in a row. It sounds like this. Here's the crux. These 3-5-1 resolutions from D to G are beginning to tonicize G major. In other words, our ears are beginning to accept that we are leaving the key of C and shifting the tonal center of the music to G. Mozart now slows the harmonic rhythm to one chord per measure and progresses G major, C major, A minor, D major, like this. G major, C major, A minor, D major, ending on a half cadence that leaves us hanging in the air for just a bit. At this point, our ears tell us that we have most likely arrived at another important structural division. As I said, the D major half cadence creates the feeling that we are hanging in the air, waiting to resolve, in fact, begging to resolve. All Mozart needs to do is to give us a G major chord, and the door will slam shut on the old key of C major. This section, which began in the key of C major and ended in the key of G major, is our second large section and is called the transition or the bridge. And I prefer to call it the bridge because of the image it creates.
You're listening to On the Keys. On this show, Douglas Weeks shows us the inner workings of sonata form. Sonata form, the drama within.
Now I'm going to play the entire bridge again, beginning in C major and ending in G. Okay, we're at the beginning of our new key area of G, and Mozart could have launched right into it. But that would have been too predictable for Mozart. Instead of jumping right in, he makes us wait by continuing the half cadence for two more measures with a slow trill before finally resolving to G. In other words, after so much hoopla about arriving in the new key of G, he cadences without fanfare, a very nice example of Mozart's deft touch and his sense of humor. So to recap, so to speak, from the beginning of the piece until somewhere in the bridge, C major was the home key and G major functioned as the dominant of the tonic. But gradually that relationship changed, and now G major is functioning as a new tonic, a new center of gravity, with C major relegated to the position of subdominant, the four chord in G. We have successfully changed the key signature and are now at the beginning of what we will call our second subject area. Mozart's task in this section is to reinforce and strengthen G as the new home, to buff it up, so to speak. With the arrival of the second subject area, we hear a new theme, which is called the B theme. And Mozart creates stability through phrasing in four measure groups, as opposed to the three and five measure uneven phrase groups that we heard in the first key area. And he provides tonal stability through using mostly tonic and dominant chords, the presence of which continue to confirm that we are in the key of G. In fact, from here to the end of the exposition, the large majority of the 52 chords heard will be either tonic or dominant, further continuing the tonicization process. I'll start at the beginning of the second subject area, calling out the chord functions in our new key of G. One, five, one, five, one, five, one, five, one, five, one, five, one, one, four, one, five, one, four, one, four, one, five, one, four, one, five, whoops. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, we hear a fully diminished seventh chord that completely disrupts the key, as fully diminished chords are wont to do. It almost sounds like an alarm bell, with the left hand repeatedly pounding out that diminished chord. The chord immediately resolves to A minor as the right hand trills down, and just for an instant, we think that maybe Mozart has decided to modulate to another key, perhaps like this. But it's another red herring. A minor immediately resolves to our new home key of G, specifically a G chord in second inversion, followed by the most powerful, perfect, authentic cadence yet, a full measure on the dominant. while the right hand trills before resolving with utter authority to tonic G major. Here's the chord progression from the diminished chord. A minor, G major, D, and the very strong cadence. Because of this powerful cadence, we again sense that we've arrived at an important structural division, and indeed, we are at the very end of the exposition, the first large section in sonata form. Well, almost at the very end, because Mozart could have stopped here, and perhaps with two concluding chords like this. But instead, he continues with a new melody whose character contrasts the excitement we've just heard. This is the closing theme, and it functions much like an afterthought or a postscript. Closing themes are rarely very long in early classical piano literature. Here, the two measures of quiet calm are repeated with sudden gusto. And the end, as expected, has a powerful, perfect, authentic cadence. That slams the door shut. And thus we come to the end of the first big section of sonata form, the exposition. It consisted of the C major first subject area with its A theme, the bridge, and the G major second subject area, which presented the B theme and a few others, including the closing theme.
You're listening to On the Keys. On this show, Douglas Weeks shows us the inner workings of sonata form. Sonata form, the drama within.
So now that we've examined the exposition in some detail, I'd like to go back and play it in its entirety once more, straight through, calling out the key divisions, pun intended, as I go. By the way, in the classical era and even well into the early Romantic era, composers put repeat marks at the end of the expositions. Why? Because hearing the exposition a second time would better enable the listener to hear its structure in an era when the only way to hear music was to hear it live. Here again is the exposition. End of first subject area, beginning of bridge. End of bridge, beginning of second subject area. New theme. Mm-hmm. closing. And before we go on, a postscript. Mozart composed the sonata in the German city of Mannheim, which was famous for, among other things, its wonderful court orchestra, which in turn inspired prominent composers to compose for it. Among the innovations associated with the Mannheim school is the Mannheim Rocket, a variation of which we heard at the beginning of the bridge, and the Mannheim Echo, which we heard in the first subject area. Next week, I'll talk about the development and recapitulation sections, but not in nearly as much detail as I did just now. We'll also look at a few other movements by Mozart, as well as some movements by Haydn and Beethoven, to better understand and hear the different ways that these three great composers of the classical era experimented with sonata form.
And that's our show. You've been listening to On the Keys here on South Carolina Public Radio. Douglas Weeks, professor of piano at Converse College, was our guest. You can listen on demand to that show and find learning aids at our website, scpublicradio.org. Tune in next week for Sonata Form Part 2. I'm David Kaiser. Have a musical week.